say. Pass the peas like you used to say. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall, and today it's another edition of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Monica is a licensed nutritionist, an author, and a speaker. She's also the host of the Nutrition Diva podcast and the Change Academy podcast, which focuses on the art and science of behavior change. Yesterday, Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff announced a new initiative by the Biden administration to address hunger. Mr. Emhoff announced a $1.7 billion program to promote healthy eating and to make healthy food more accessible. According to the Food Research and Action Center, one in eight households, or nearly 13% of families in the United States, experiences food insecurity, or they don't have access to nutritional, affordable food. In an interview on CNBC, Gary Pilnick, the CEO of cereal giant Kellogg's, said that one solution to the affordability dilemma is to eat cereal for dinner. Pan-roasted Frosted Flakes with a champagne basil cream sauce, anybody? Monica Reinagle joins me today in Studio A. It's good to see you.
Great to be with you, Tom.
So let's talk a little bit about the White House's approach to hunger. The $1.7 billion that Mr. Emhoff announced yesterday is in addition to $8 billion or something that they allocated towards what President Biden's calling the challenge. What is the challenge?
To reduce hunger, to increase access to nutritious foods. And we should say that this $1.7 billion that they were talking about yesterday isn't all money that the government is spending. This represents commitments that they have gotten other stakeholders to make, for-profit corporations, nonprofits, government agencies. So they're really trying to build a multi-level, multi-dimensional approach and to involve more than just government agencies in this work.
Yeah, we're a rich country. We've got a lot of rich people. We've got a lot of people who, you know, don't give a second thought to whether or not they have a meal to look forward to at the various times of day. But there's a lot of people who struggle. I mean, they open that refrigerator and there's nothing in it, and they open that cupboard and there's nothing in it.
I think this is really a very misunderstood phenomenon in our society. And you'll notice they also have a lot of star power behind this initiative. They have Jose Andres, very famous chef, also involved in a lot of humanitarian efforts around food, and the Harlem Globetrotters and other sports and entertainment figures. And I think that is really in an effort to increase awareness of this issue because, as you said, one in eight households is experiencing food insecurity. And that doesn't count the households that are really just one paycheck, one health crisis, one really expensive car repair away from suddenly not being sure how or whether they're going to put food on the table. And, you know, you can't. I think one of the reasons this is a little invisible is because it might not be obvious to you which of your neighbors may be suffering from food insecurity. You can't tell by looking at someone.
Yeah, you think, oh, if someone's hungry, you know, she's probably skinny and, you know, malnourished. Not always the case.
Yeah, actually, it can be the opposite. My neighborhood association is always trying to campaign to get the potholes on our street filled. And then as soon as the street is smooth, they want to have speed bumps put in. And I always think, half jokingly, well, the potholes were actually doing a pretty good job at keeping the speed down. But that's a joke. But I think sometimes people apply the same false logic to this. We have a big obesity problem in this country. We have a food insecurity problem. And there's a big overlap in those populations. And someone might think, like, well, there's your solution. If you don't have enough food, maybe that'll address the epidemic of obesity. Not at all the case. Some of the behaviors that can contribute to overweight and obesity may actually be a response to food insecurity.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. It's Smart Nutrition here on Midday. If you'd like to share your thoughts about hunger and how to address it here in the United States, 410-662-8780. A little bit later, we'll speak with Carmen Del Guecho, who is the president and CEO of the Maryland Food Bank. There's been an uptick in folks needing the services that Maryland Food Bank provides. He'll be joining us a little bit later in the program. You can join us now. Again, the number 410-662-8780 or our email, midday@wipr.org. So you mentioned the Harlem Globetrotters are part of this effort. There's some 14 sports leagues and stuff, and they're going to talk about integrating physical activity into, you know, daily routines for folks, especially kids. I was taken by some of the initiatives around educating medical students, people who are studying to be doctors, about nutrition. This was interesting. There are a couple of different companies that medical schools bring in. I mean, they outsource nutrition education in med school. It's not doesn't seem to be part of the regular curriculum in a lot of med schools. That's really interesting. I mean, as a nutritionist, I wonder what your reaction to that is.
Well, that's been a long been a complaint about medical training and education, is the docs are not getting good education in nutrition, and yet people are still looking to doctors for that kind of guidance. Now, we do have an entire other profession of nutrition and dietetics where people are getting that training, and I'd love to see those two professions teaming up and working together. But in the meantime, it's a move in the right direction to be including more basic nutrition information in the medical curriculum for doctors so that they can recognize when they are looking at someone who may be food insecure, who may not be getting regular, adequate nutrition, that would be more obvious to them. They might even just be more sensitized to the prevalence of this problem.
And just to understand that, you know, perhaps change in diet or, you know, improving the diet could obviously help, you know, with whatever medical problems they're encountering. But you've written extensively about something I never knew was a thing. It's the medicine, you know, food as medicine movement. This notion that if you just eat the right things, you got clear sailing. Not so much.
Right. And this is being largely driven by physicians, by medical doctors who recognize the importance of diet and other lifestyle as being a key determinant of long-term health. And I think that this movement is well-intentioned, you know, by making people aware that the choices that they're making has such a big impact on their risk of certain long-term chronic conditions. If that inspires people and motivates people to make healthier choices, great. My concern about the food as medicine movement is that it overlooks the fact that we don't all have the same access to those healthy choices. And, you know, we need to address some of the accessibility issues before we can start insisting that people take control and take responsibility for their health. That's a lot easier for people who have a kitchen to cook in and are not food insecure and have all the resources, the time, the skills, the know-how to use food as quote-unquote medicine. And the other concern I have with this is that it creates the impression that if you do end up suffering from some sort of condition, then maybe it's your fault because you didn't make the right choices.
You have heart disease because of what you ate. Yeah,
right. That's not only untrue, because you can do all the right things and still end up with type 2 diabetes, with heart disease, with cancer. It's also supremely unhelpful for someone to feel guilty or ashamed or to be stigmatized for what we refer to as lifestyle diseases. We kind of build it right into the description there. So those are some of my concerns with the lifestyle as medicine movement. I respect what they're trying to accomplish. I just want to temper it with a little bit more sensitivity to just how complex these issues are.
You wrote, and this was a revelation to me, there's actually a study where doctors were prescribing produce. They were like writing scripts for produce, you know? So instead of, you know, take three Tylenols or something, they're saying go buy three crowns of broccoli. And they did a study about that.
Right.
But the study had perhaps some counterintuitive conclusions.
Yeah, this is the apotheosis of the food as medicine movement, right? We're going to write scripts for vegetables. What it did expose was that that is just one piece of the puzzle, and there are a lot of other pieces in the puzzle that need to be in place for people to consistently make those healthy choices. So we're going to have to do a little bit better than just writing cute prescriptions for fruits and vegetables, or even, you know, there's big efforts to try to address what we call food deserts, where if you're shopping at a grocery store, Tom, you may be making a choice to buy fresh vegetables instead of potato chips. But if a convenience store is the only place that you can buy groceries for your family, that's not really as available a choice for you.
Sure. So, you know, and getting grocery stores to locate, I know here in Baltimore, that's a real, real challenge. Councilwoman Felicia Porter was just successful in attracting a new grocery store to where a Safeway grocery store and then another one had been in South Baltimore for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it took forever.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking to some folks who were involved in the development of the Rotunda over on 41st Street. And there's a mom's grocery store that appears to be quite successful. Every time you pass by or go in there, it's mobbed with people. But moms, I think, I don't think this is telling tales out of school, was like the seventh or eighth choice of a grocery store for that location by the folks who were developing the Rotunda. They couldn't find anybody else. Moms was one of the few chains that was, you know, willing to do it, which is, you know, it's a really tough thing. And there are so many food deserts here in Baltimore.
There are. And we should be continuing to try to address that. But again, even irrigating the food deserts with more accessible grocery stores, one piece of the puzzle. We still need to make sure that people have the space and the equipment that they would need to cook at home, that people may not necessarily have cooking skills. They may not know what to do with that fresh produce when they get home. There's a, you know, there's a hurdle that has to be overcome in acquiring an appreciation and an enjoyment of these foods. So yeah, it's that's a piece of the puzzle. But what I appreciate about this commitment, this program, that the White House is championing here is that they really are looking at this in a very multifactorial way and trying to get a lot of those pieces to fall a little bit more into place so that we can make some traction on this. As you said, it is absurd that a country with our resources has 1 in 8 households not quite sure whether they're going to be able to put a meal on the table every day this week.
Yeah. And part of the initiative has an organization called Food Forward, which is a produce recovery company. So they take produce that otherwise is going to be discarded, and they make sure it gets into homes of people who need it.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because one of the other ironic pieces of this puzzle is the amount of food that we throw away.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a third or so of the food that we produce in this country ends up in the trash. And that's not only a shame in terms of what that could be doing to address hunger, it's also a real environmental concern, because the methane that is produced as organic scraps and food breakdown in our landfills is a major contributor to greenhouse gases. We know we can't really afford to be stoking that particular fire. So creative efforts to redirect good food that is otherwise on its way to the landfill for reasons like there's no place to store it, or, you know, too much in the wrong place. Trying to capture that and make that more available and reduce food waste is another really important part of this puzzle.
Yeah. I remember years ago, our good friend John Shields was talking about the farm-to-table movement. Mm-hmm. And one of the barriers for restaurants was that people had an expectation. And this is literally years ago. So 10, 12, 15 years ago. I don't know how long ago. They had problems if a restaurant served, you know, like red potatoes that all weren't, you know, the perfect golf ball size. You know, if there's a red potato that's at all malformed, it was an outrage. And restaurants were reluctant to actually serve that food. And it took a while to, educate the public to say, you know, the red potato that looks a little weird is just as good as the red potato that's a perfect cylinder.
Or even better, because it came from a nearby farm.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, part of it is what consumers expect and require. And I do, in that regard, I want you to comment on what folks are calling the Marie Antoinette moment of the fellow who is the CEO.
That's what I've been calling it anyway.
the CEO of the Kellogg's Corporation, the big cereal manufacturer, a guy named Gary Pilnick. He did an interview on CNBC about an ad campaign, and I've actually seen one of these commercials. Where Kellogg's is encouraging people, well, don't cook tonight. Give the chickens a night off. Have cereal for dinner, you know? And people like you and others are comparing it to the let them eat cake, comment by Marie Antoinette. But it turns out it's not a completely horrible idea.
Yeah, that was unfortunate. I'm sure he wished he could have taken that that back. But it obscures the fact that there's some truth to this, especially in this discussion that we're having today about food insecurity. Cereal turns out to be, it's a highly fortified food. And that makes it one of the chief delivery systems for several nutrients that we're concerned about, that people are regularly not getting enough of.
And we're talking about cereals like Frosted Flakes and Mini Wheats and stuff.
Right.
There are tons of sugar, too. But, right?
But they can be a very significant source of these nutrients, and not just any old nutrients, but what we call nutrients of concern. And they play an even bigger role in supplying those nutrients in lower income households. And, you know, they're very cost effective way to address some nutrient shortfalls. About 85%, I think, of ready to eat cereal is consumed with milk, which is another really important delivery mechanism. Calcium, vitamin D. It can be the primary source of milk in kids' diets. So, yes, cereal actually can play a role here in the fight against hunger, in the fight against food insecurity and malnutrition by delivering a lot of nutrition for not much money in a way that most people do find accessible and palatable.
Yeah. People studied this and they found that people, you wrote about this, if they eat ready-to-eat cereals like Cheerios, Frosted Flakes, that kind of thing, they generally have a higher intake of vitamins A, D, calcium, iron, fiber, and other nutrients. So it ain't all bad.
Well, you know, we're in this moment right now where we've demonized processed foods and ultra processed foods as being the root of all evil, and we're taught to shop the perimeter of the grocery store, which is where all the healthy food supposedly hangs out, and ready to eat cereal not on the perimeter of the grocery store, but certainly can play a valuable role in meeting nutrient needs.
Yeah, and it's a matter of, you know, offsetting the downside of the Frosted Flakes with all the sugar and stuff. I mean, it's a matter of, you know, if it's the only thing you're eating for dinner, you know.
It's not a complete
six
diet.
6 nights in a row, that's
for
not a
sure.
good idea.
Yeah. Right. But I have to confess, I had that bias about the sugar-sweetened breakfast cereals, too, that the sugar more than offset any valuable nutrition. And I was a little bit surprised to see what a small proportion of added sugars those cereals, even the sweetened ones, end up contributing to the overall diet. They're not a major source of sugar in the diet in practice, and they are a major source of nutrition. So I've had to kind of reel that in a little bit. If you can sell plain Cheerios to your toddler, go for that. You know,
right.
But if you can't, we shouldn't be discarding this out of hand.
Yeah, and the Biden initiative announced yesterday includes things like using AI. This is an AI, you know, medical application that we hear about to do dietary management platforms and stuff, and to help people with the use of apps and stuff. And you and I have talked about apps in terms of diet and monitoring your intake of nutrients, but also to help with things like affordability and accessibility. You know, apps that can show you how far away, you know, the next good grocery store is. Excuse me, and ways of getting, you know, getting to it. So there's all sorts of, you know, there's a lot of different initiatives in this plan, which seems pretty well thought out to me as I read it.
I was reading an article in the New York Times over the weekend about apps that actually help people identify food that will otherwise be thrown away from grocery stores, from retail out, you know, bakeries or restaurants, and you can feed yourself on a couple dollars a day and do pretty well. Another example of how we can use technology to try to, you know, stop food throwing food away, start routing it where it can do some good for people.
There's a organization in North Carolina, Blue Cross Blue Shield. They're going to expand one-on-one nutrition coaching. That obviously will help you do a lot of that with folks.
I do.
And it's important, especially if people are coming to it, you know, without a long history of, you know, figuring out what's the best way to eat nutritionally.
Yeah. And the kind of coaching that would be helpful to augment that with is just basic coaching on meal planning and how to manage your shopping and your food inventory, basic meal prep for people that are not. I mean, I'm old enough that when I was in middle school and junior high, we still had home ec and we got some basic training in kitchen skills. That's long gone. Well, the guys were in shop, right? Making bird feeders and ashtrays. We were learning how to boil an egg, but that's long since gone from public education. And we have a couple of generations now of people who have grown up really without the slightest idea how to cook. And that's just a basic skill that can make an enormous difference in our ability to feed ourselves well and to feed our children well.
Yeah, there's also an initiative to do as many as a million different assessments about the non-medical barriers to health. We're talking about food deserts. We're talking about transportation issues. We're talking about, you know, environmental issues and stuff. Health is a composite of a lot of different factors.
Right. And so can we really say food is medicine in that in that context?
Yeah. I mean, medicine is medicine. Food is
food. Food is food. Thank you.
Indeed. Monica Reinagle is a licensed nutritionist and the host of the Nutrition Diva podcast and the Change Academy podcast. And coming up, Carmen Del Guecho, who is the president and CEO of the Maryland Food Bank, joins us to continue our conversation about hunger here in Maryland and throughout the country. We'll have more smart nutrition after a quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And before we head to a break, I want to let you know about a mayoral forum that I'll be moderating tonight with Lisa Snowden, the founder and editor of the Baltimore Beat. We'll have 10 candidates for mayor. They'll be at the Mount Lebanon Baptist Church on Reisterstown Road. Registration begins at 5:30, and the forum starts at 6 o'clock. It's sponsored by Baltimore Green Space. That's a coalition of environmental groups, and we'll ask the candidates their views on environmental issues. So I hope you can join us either in person or online tonight at Mount Lebanon Baptist Church. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Katherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the show, are TIFs working? TIFs are tax increment financing. It's a tool that cities like Baltimore use to attract development. But the costs are substantial. And long term, we wonder, does it make sense? We'll talk with Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal about that. Plus, Allison Colden of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. We'll talk about the environmental legislative priorities in front of the General Assembly for this year's session. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday.
Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say.
And if you've just joined us today, it's Smart Nutrition here on Midday. We're talking about how best to address hunger in America. Monica Reinagle is a licensed nutritionist and the host of the Nutrition Diva podcast and the Change Academy podcast. She joins me here in Studio A. And joining us now is Carmen Delguecho. He's the executive director of the Maryland Food Bank, the president and CEO, I should say, of the Maryland Food Bank. And he joins us on Zoom. Carmen, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Thanks, Tom, for having me. Appreciate it.
So there's been an uptick in the number of Marylanders who are needing the services that that you offer. Tell us about that. How do things compare now, for example, with the way things were during the pandemic and before the pandemic?
Yeah, definitely seen an uptick, especially over the last, I would say, 4 to 5 months. We've seen a distinct increase in the number of pounds and need and demands we have on our organization. So, you know, we are seeing about 1 in 3 Marylanders who are struggling to make ends meet. And I would say that's definitely higher than it was pre-pandemic, probably in line slightly below what we saw during the pandemic itself. So not quite back to pandemic levels, but clearly well above it was leading into that.
I think it's somewhere around 200,000 more people from last year. I mean, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of new people needing food from the Maryland Food Bank.
Yeah, putting a lot of pressure on us from that perspective. And there's a number of factors that are contributing to that, right? You hear a lot of positive economic news out there these days, but it doesn't seem to be translating in reduced demand for sure.
So part of your data suggests that something on the order of 1 in 3 Marylanders may face food insecurity at a particular time, maybe not all the time, but at some time. I mean, that's a lot of people. That's 2 million residents.
Right.
How are you responding to this increased demand? I mean, what's that mean for your organization?
Yeah, I mean, that means we have to buy more food than we ever have. And that's one thing that has changed dramatically since the pandemic, because this increased demand, we historically relied very heavily on donated product to help us meet demand. And while that donated stream continues to be there today, grocery stores don't really have more food than they did 3 or 4 years ago, frankly. Actually, they probably have less because they're doing a better job of managing their businesses. And so that puts the only way we can meet increased demand is to buy more food. And so now we buy nearly 40% of the food we distribute, we actually buy, which puts a lot of pressure on us from a budgeting perspective.
And of course, you know, among the reasons that there has been this uptick, there were a lot of benefits that were available to folks during the pandemic, like the Child Tax Credit Program, SNAP benefits, Medicaid. The number of people on Medicaid has been decreased. There was rental assistance for people, but those programs have dried up now that the pandemic is considered, you know, not a pandemic anymore. And plus we've got inflation. So when you have to buy food, it's costing you more than it used to, you know, a year or two ago.
Oh, absolutely. So yeah, it's a perfect storm, right? So those rollback of those critical federal assistance programs, and then you tie in the fact that inflation and cost of living and food affordability, you know, has risen dramatically over the last couple of years. And that puts strain on households all across our state, you know, from low income to medium income households are feeling the effect of that. You know, all of us feel it when we go to the grocery store. And it's also put an effect on our business. I talked about us buying a lot more food than we had historically, but now it's costing us more to buy that product at the same time. So we got an added burden there. And to kind of tie into some of the conversation you've been having, we are trying to be much more intentional about the nutritional content of the food we're buying to provide to our neighbors at the same time. So, and typically, for better or for worse, that food is more expensive than maybe less nutritious options.
Yeah. Now, the food is more expensive. However, you do recommend, as I understand it, that if people want to help the Maryland Food Bank, it's better to give monetary financial support to the food bank rather than buy cans of soup or boxes of, you know, macaroni and cheese and bring them over to the food bank distribution centers. And that's because your dollar, when it comes to buying food, goes a lot longer than our dollars when we're shopping in a grocery store.
That's exactly right. I mean, so we're spending $25 million a year on food. That gives us tremendous buying power. And so that dollar or $2 that someone might be spending at a grocery store to buy 2 or 3 cans of vegetables, for instance, we can probably double that the purchase power of that dollar for folks. So, and then the second piece of it, frankly, is the fact that we understand the needs in our communities better than most. And so while we appreciate people going to the grocery store and buying a can of something that they think our neighbors might like. We obviously are interacting with our neighbors every day. And so we know exactly what communities all across our state are looking for, neighbors all across our state are looking for. And so we can buy the right product at a more less expensive price.
So the two things that folks can do if they want to help, make a donation to the Maryland Food Bank, but also volunteer. You use lots and lots of people who donate their time. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, critical component to our overall mission is our volunteer network. And so we have a number of ways in which people can participate in helping us in our cause. I mean, so if you're not able to donate your treasure, hopefully you can donate your time. We have over 15,000 shifts over the course of a year. That's almost 37,000 volunteer hours doing everything from packing boxes to helping us prepare meals to stuffing envelopes to answering the phones and interacting with neighbors in our community. So anything that you might be interested in, we can probably find a spot for you to help us out.
That's great. And you have locations all around the state, right?
Well, our physical locations, our biggest locations in Halethorpe down here by the airport, and we have a facility in Salisbury and one in Hagerstown. And then if someone chooses or prefers to work in their local community, we work with 330 community-based organizations all across our state that we can also connect folks to help our neighbor or help our network partners to support their communities.
Carmen Del Guecho is the president and CEO of the Maryland Food Bank. Thanks so much for your time. I'm glad you let folks know the ways that they can help, because I'm sure we've got a lot of listeners who would very much like to get involved. So thanks. Appreciate it.
Appreciate the opportunity, Tom. Thank you very much.
So, Monica Reinagle, you know, there are ways to help, but this notion of awareness of hunger, I think, is really, really important. We touched on this earlier in the show. It's not always to the naked eye apparent that a person is having an issue with food insecurity.
I think we saw this, as Carmen was referencing, in the early days of the pandemic. And suddenly the demand on the food pantries was enormous. It surprised a lot of people to see the number of our neighbors who suddenly needed help. And it really reinforced just how common this is, how close to that line many people are living. But as that has receded more into the mists of history, you know, we're in danger of losing our awareness about this and maybe losing the impetus to try to help. So one nice thing about this new initiative is it kind of puts it front and center. And I also wanted to just mention a sort of parallel movement to efforts to address hunger and to supply food, and that is the food dignity movement, which recognizes that people who might need to rely on donated food or a food kitchen still have a right to a certain amount of dignity. And often that means choice, that they have the ability to choose what they want to eat and not have to just take what somebody else has chosen for them, or their right to enjoy something that's really beautiful or delicious, gorgeous produce, you know, that it elevates, you know, it's hard enough to need assistance to feed your family. And we don't want to add injury to insult by making it a really demeaning, degrading experience. And so the food dignity movement is kind of coupling up with the food insecurity and hunger relief efforts to try to preserve as much dignity as we can in that situation.
That's a really important point. You know, if you need to rely on SNAP benefits, for example, mm-hmm. to get food, you can go to a farmer's market. The farmer's markets that I go to and you go to all accept SNAP cards and stuff. But you got to get to the farmer's market, first of all. And a lot of times transportation is a big barrier. And then when you get there, you know, you have to be conscious of, you know, the people who are paying cash and the people who are using SNAP benefits. And the social dynamic there can be difficult. And it's up to those of us who, you know, have many blessings that others don't to be sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm. And yet the fact that all of those populations can come together at our local neighborhood food markets is a wonderful thing.
And I understand Carmen is still with us. Carmen, you have another point you want to make?
Well, I just I stayed on. And so I appreciate the conversation that you, Monica, went down this dignity path. And I think I just want, and this notion of choice. I mean, that's something I wanted to just emphasize from our perspective as well. Monica, your point's well taken. And during COVID, just because of the nature of the level, the minimizing interactions, a lot of distributions became very impersonal and not very dignified, right? There's prepackaged boxes that were just handed to people who might have been coming through in their cars so we can minimize the touch. But that's not the model that we're striving to create. And we're trying, you know, we consider ourselves a food bank of choice. So we talked about nutrition earlier. We're not here to dictate to any family what they should or shouldn't feed their feed their families. All of us have one indulge in a cookie or a cake from time to time. But we do want to provide that Delo a choice, the dignified nature of that. But we also want to create a dignified kind of shopping experience at our partners. So really encouraging our partner network to create very welcoming environments for folks who come into their facilities to access food, to make it very welcoming, to make it very personal, to make it very dignified, and allow for a choice for folks to choose what it is they want to provide their families. And what we're trying to do is to educate while we do that with nice signage and things like that, to try to nudge people along on this nutrition continuum to focus on the foods that we think are better for them. And so when I started hearing you talking about that, I really wanted the opportunity to chime in, because I think that's a critical focus for us as a food bank. Because we're not here just to distribute food. We're trying to do that in a very dignified way, and in choice and dignity are exactly what we're focused on. So when you guys said those terms right after my segment, I didn't want to lose the opportunity to kind of say,
I appreciate your chiming in, because it's a really important point. And I remember when you and I talked at the beginning, or in the early months of the pandemic, there were a lot of people. There was one month where 300,000 people in Maryland applied for unemployment benefits. And so these were people who were coming to the Maryland Food Bank for the first time. They had never experienced food insecurity. Right. They had never had to go through that experience. And I would imagine that, you know, given the uptick that we're seeing now, that includes a good number of people who, again, this is a new experience. This is a new challenge. And that's a whole different dynamic, you know, isn't it? Yeah, it's important.
We monitor Google search trends, because we see that's a leading indicator for the demand that we're going to see down the road, because people who are going online to search to find food are clearly not folks who are accessing the system today. And so through the first half of February, you know, so this is live now, our searches were up 75% over February of last year. So that's an indication to us is the demand that we're seeing today that is at this high level is likely to continue, because we got this amount of activity going on with regard to people who don't know how to access the food assistance network. We're searching to try to do that. It's telling us that's what's coming down the pike.
All right, Cameron Delguecho, again, the executive director, the president and CEO of the Maryland Food Bank. Monica Reinagel is the host of the Nutrition Diva podcast and the Change Academy podcast, which focuses on the art and science of behavior change. Thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And this breaking news coming right across the wires now from the Associated Press, Mitch McConnell, who is the longest serving Senate leader in history, has decided to step down from his leadership position. He will no longer be the minority leader in the Senate as of November. So Mitch McConnell announcing his intention to resign from the leadership of the Senate. That is breaking news at this hour. We'll have more on that at the Midday News Wrap on Friday. And coming up today, Midday in the Neighborhood. We're going to explore the legacy of black businesses in Mount Vernon with Nick Team of the Baltimore Banner. And Nick joins us on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.